It was nearly an hour later when he woke, and he stood up and slid his arms into his jacket and shuffled through to the next room. It was empty, with the bare bulb still alight as it hung from the ceiling. The copy of Time was still there, and he leafed through the first few pages to find the photograph. It was on here under the headline, "Gallup and Harris Say It's Powell." He sat down in the chair, shivering slightly from the cold. There were 8 people in the photograph, all smiling into the camera, and the caption read, "With a 19% lead in the polls, candidate Logan Powell and campaign manager Andrew Dempsey return to Hartford for the final days of the campaign." He bent forward and switched on the electric fire. If you saw a face in a magazine, you assumed you recognized it because it was well-known and familiar, a film star or some public figure. But that wasn't why the photograph had stayed in his mind. He remembered Dempsey now. It had been in Paris, May 1968, and the song had said it was the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. On the streets of Paris, the students were demonstrating against the government. That was where he had last seen Andy Dempsey, with bright red blood soaking his white shirt from a broken nose as they slung him back into the black van. After the taunting shouts, they had thrown cobbles from the streets at the police, before the SDECE with the black crosses on their white helmets came in. It was they who had beaten up Dempsey and his girl as the barriers came down. Her mouth had been wide open as she screamed as the thug twisted her breast and kneed her groin. Then he had lost sight of her as she fell to the ground in the forest of feet and legs. Dempsey was an American, and his girl was a Russian or a Pole, he couldn't remember which. That was the last time he had seen them. He had been withdrawn to London just afterwards. It had been one of his first jobs for SIS, a low-profile penetration of student groups in Paris. And Dempsey had been on his list as a member of the Communist Party and intimately involved with a Soviet citizen. His reports would still be on file. He switched off the fire and went back to bed. From the opening pages of Ted Albury's The 20th Day of January. Well, Albury's work has been compared to that of spy novelist John Le Carré. And I got to say, the book starts out well enough with its late 1970s and early 1980s setting in Washington, D.C., in London, and in Paris, the time in which the book was actually written. And note, there is little action here. It's a thriller. As other reviewers have noted, the 20th day of January gets its gumption from intrigue and from investigation. The storyline is not too far-fetched. As many reviewers have already noted, the 20th day of January could have been ripped from today's headlines, though it was published way back in 1980. Here's why. Our story opens, as we just heard, with up-and-coming British spy James Bruce McKay recognizing the top advisor to likely-to-be-elected president as a young fellow our spy ran into during the infamous Paris student riots of 1968. It seems McKay had been sent to Paris, as we just heard, to infiltrate the student groups earlier. And as he literally ran into the future to be top presidential advisor, he was an undergrad student protester, a young American studying abroad, deeply infatuated, need we call it love, with a Moscow-funded co-ed who was known as a party member and presumed, since she was allowed to attend university in Paris, a well-thought-of member of the Soviet Communist Party. As McKay remembers that not-so-long-ago summer, about 12 years later, our future presidential advisor had become a Communist Party member as well. And so the modern-day question arose, modern-day being 1980, is that now significant political player, a Communist Party member still? Is he a plant in waiting for his spy masters in Moscow? Is the U.S. public about to elect a president whose closest advisor is a Soviet communist spy? Well, once McKay shares his concerns with his superiors in the British Secret Service, they are not pleased with the looming possibility. In the highest ranks of the British Secret Service reached out to their colleagues and the American CIA to share their concerns. The top Central Intelligence Agency chieftain takes a personal interest in the possibility that Americans are about to elect a Soviet-influenced president. But naturally, once all this investigated on the down low, there are politics, there are personal rivalries. So we're off into a murky spy story that takes our protagonists back to the tumultuous months, first of 1968, a year when former World War II General de Gaulle holds a tenuous presidency in France, when U.S. President Lyndon Johnson is about to hand over a deeply divided nation to Richard Nixon, and what was then called Red China had just exploded a nuclear bomb. As they investigate what was really going on in the Paris that summer of 1968, and soon enough, we're all yanked back to the current days of 1980, when the Soviets were far from calling it quits in their rivalry with the United States and their Western allies. And so our story shifts to high boil. Will our spooks break through the shadowy world of espionage to discover the truth? Well, we're kept on the edge of our seat as they, and we, wonder if the truth they discovered will be recognized by the powers that be in Washington, D.C. soon enough to have an impact and to perhaps even end, before it begins, a presidency by a Soviet-leaning president taking office on that famous day of January 20th. The story is, as you can tell, eerily predictive of today's news, and it's perhaps why this book, first published in 1980, was published again just this spring in 2017. A businessman experiences a meteoric rise to first the governorship of Connecticut, and then achieves the nomination of his political party, a soon-to-be president-elect, whose closest aide is presumed by both British and American intelligence officials to be a Soviet plant, perhaps even a Soviet spy. Well, every good spy novel needs good guys and villains. The aforementioned Le Carré was known for breaking or at least stretching that mold by showing that good and evil are contingent on one's point of view. And we see echoes of that ambiguity in the 20th day of January, too. Author Ted Albury, a spy master himself, his professional life before he started writing novels found him deeply involved with British intelligence agencies in World War II and after. Gives us what we've come to expect as an inside look at the spy world. And not being one myself, I'll take it on trust from others that Albury does a good job of just that. A couple of rings true to its day observations as well. The story that the 20th day of January tells is an all-guys game. No women are allowed to play important roles in this spy novel, though two women in particular are allowed to be important peripheral players, dipping in and out of the action and the storyline. And the references that author Albury makes to the incredible mess created in spy world by the Philby scandal is a nifty inside the Beltway reference to a major East-West spy scandal from the 1960s, certainly still remembered by the year 1980. Finally, it's worth noting that the 20th day of January is told from a British perspective, our author being just that. And that perspective offers the reader an interesting tip of the hat to the openness of American politics when our author has our Scottish hero muse that America is different from Britain. No Watergate scandal, which in 1980 was fresh in the minds of just about every reader, could happen in Britain, he tells us. That was an American scandal, an American success story, if you will. Well, let's finish rather early still in our novel. As our new president-elect, he does indeed win. Those double-digit polls were quite well predictive. Our new president realizes that his own political skills have not gotten him into the most powerful office in the world. Instead, the political machinations of a foreign power have played a major role in getting him there. We join our story. Logan Powell spent the whole day taking briefings and situation papers from the present administration. Sitting President Grover was philosophical about his defeat. His 4 years in office had seen no great issues resolved. If anything, issues had been ignored and it looked as if the American public liked it that way. They wanted peace, prosperity, and a chance to play with their toys. For 2 days, Andrew Dempsey had examined position papers and reports and made those routine decisions that allowed his temporary team to function while the newly elected president's major appointments were being considered. It was time to convert euphoria to usable energy. He picked up Powell from his temporary office and drove him to the hotel. Dempsey had arranged for them to have adjoining suites, with the flanking suites taking as offices. They sat in shirt sleeves and comfortable armchairs, and President-elect Powell gave him instructions about various people he wanted to see in the next 2 days. Dempsey poured them another drink before he started what he expected to be the first of a series of tense dialogues. "There's something I need to talk with you about, Logan. I've told Cheevers to put out a press release tonight that I've appointed you presidential chief of staff," Powell said. "It wasn't that. It's about you."
"Oh? What about me?"
"You know that we've had a lot of help from way back to get you in the White House."
"Sure, I know. They'll all get their piece of cake in due course."
"Most of the help came from the same quarter, Logan. I'm sure you recognize that."
"What are you trying to tell me?"
"There are things that they want."
"Like what?"
"Well, a peace pact, troops withdrawn from Europe, trade both ways."
"Those are issues for governments, not individuals."
Dempsey looked steadily back at newly elected President Logan Powell. "That's what I'm trying to tell you, Logan." For a moment, he was almost convinced that the surprise on Powell's face was genuine.
"Are you saying that the Soviet government were on my side during the election?"
"They were on your side long before that, Logan. They got you into the state capitol."
"What the heck are you talking about?"
Powell's face was reddening with anger. "Who do you think made you governor?"
Powell shrugged. "They liked my program. They wanted change."
Dempsey shook his head. "There were a dozen contenders who would have been equally suitable. It was the strike got you nominated, and it was the strike got you in the state capitol.
And I arbitrated and settled the strike, for gosh sake."
"How do you think the strike started, Logan? Why do you think it just happened when your nomination was a totally outside chance?" Powell was silent for long moments, and then he said quietly, "Are you saying that they fixed a strike so I could arbitrate and look good?" "You knew that at the time, Logan. You and I don't need to pretend. But you knew when you were negotiating with the union leader that the strike had been fixed." "Logan, that leader was doing exactly what he was told to do."
"What else have they fixed?"
Powell's voice was edged with anger. "It's cost about $30 million in cashing in on 20 years of organization." Powell shook his head.
"That's their view, not mine. The people voted, and they voted for me. They're too late, my friends. I'm president-elect. And if they play games with me, they'll be exposed and sent packing."
"Your program promised peace and prosperity. You can deliver on it with help."
"What we do to get peace and prosperity will be negotiated between governments, no other way."
Nobody's suggesting any other way. To get prosperity, we need peace. They want that too. To get peace, we need disarmament. They want that too. With a peace pact, you've got billions of dollars to direct and provide the prosperity. Half a dozen administrations have tried to deliver it. Yours can be the one that succeeds.
Powell leaned back in his chair. "You've been with them all the time, Andy. You've known."
"You wanted to win, Logan. I helped you do it. Others helped me."
Dempsey knew that already Powell's mind was back in the White House. And at the back of his mind, he would be working out how to cash in on the political prizes that the Soviets were laying out in front of him.
President-elect Powell would rationalize them as being what he intended all along. It's a book that could have been ripped from the headlines of today, but instead it was written in 1980, published in 1980, and now republished in 2017. It's a novel well worth reading. Not only for the spy story it unfolds, but for the story that reflects today's news headlines, perhaps as well. It's fiction by spymaster Ted Albury. It's entitled The 20th Day of January. and it's available at all of our fine local libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.